turn the lights up in the front?
Maybe on in the back. Hey, dude, turn the lights off.
Right, so it's a pleasure to be in Davis again. Hopefully I managed to stay awake for the course of my own talk because I'm feeling pretty jet-lagged after
getting with late.
Sorry. Okay, so I want to tell you about some work that we've been doing in Nottingham over the last year or so, where we've been looking at resonant tunnelling in the string landscape. Resonant tunnelling is a phenomenon which occurs in quantum mechanics. It's a real phenomenon. It's experimentally seen. Basically, what it is it's that you imagine tunnelling through a barrier, and quantum mechanics is always exponentially suppressed, but if you have a double barrier and certain conditions are met, then actually the probability of tunnelling through that double barrier can actually be almost of order unity. So it's a resonant effect. So recently, Henry Tai sort of noticed this and sort of asked the question, well, what if something similar happens in the landscape? And that's, to some extent, that's a huge leap of faith to go from something that happens in quantum mechanics to something that happens in the landscape. But he speculated as to what implications that might have, and I'll discuss that a little bit. But what we wanted to ask was, well, how realistic is it that something like this could happen in the landscape? And actually, more specifically, what we asked was a slightly simpler question, is how realistic is that something like this could happen in quantum field theory? Okay. So we actually came up with a no-go theorem that's under a certain, which had a set of axioms that which we considered reasonable. And we actually found that resonant tunneling was actually possible, given those axioms in quantum field, standard scalar quantum field theory. We later then sort of found a way to sort of justifiably evade one of those conditions and actually produced the first known example of resonant tunnelling in quantum field theory, although it's worth saying that the example that we gave is extremely contrived. So it's not clear how relevant that would be to the landscape. So just to give you a quick overview, I basically want to start by just very briefly discussing the string landscape. I'm not an expert on this. There's people here who know a lot more about that than me. But just to set the scene, really. I then want to review Tai's idea about resonant tunnelling in the landscape and how this might work. To get a feel for resonant tunnelling, I want to discuss something which I'm calling resonant tunnelling in optics. There is an effect which is very sort of analogous to resonant tunnelling in quantum mechanics that occurs in optics, and I think it gives us good intuition in understanding how this works to actually look at this optical analogue. So I'll review that. Having got that intuition, I then want to look at resonant tunnelling in quantum mechanics. This is a real phenomenon, as I say, and discuss the details of how that goes through. And from there, I want to ask, well, what would then be required for resonant tunnelling to occur in quantum field theory? So in a sense, what I then want to, I want to make the leap from quantum mechanics to sort of n-dimensional quantum mechanics. I then want to take n to infinity to give myself quantum field theory. That's sort of going to be the logic. And then I'm going to arrive at a no-go theorem. Okay? And that no-go theorem will basically involve the decay of a homogeneous false vacuum into a bubble of true vacuum, and I'm going to show that can't happen by resonant tunnelling. I'm then going to show how to evade our no-go theorem in a very contrived scenario, and that's just going to be the last couple of slides. Okay, so the string landscape, well, sort of at the last count, give or take a few, the number of vacuum string theory is now around 10 to the 500 or so. Okay, so it's a lot, it's virtually a continuum. And basically, this perhaps came as a surprise when it was first realised, but the point is that each vacuum has its own properties which depends on the compact space that you compactify over. And what do I mean by the properties? I mean, you look at excitations around that vacuum and you establish the physical laws, the particle content, the values for the fundamental constants. And given so many vacua, it seems reasonable to expect that at least one of these excitations about this vacuum would correspond to our known universe. So in the sense that it contains the standard model and a small positive vacuum energy. But of course, that doesn't answer the question in how and why was our universe selected amongst this 10 to the 500 possibilities. In fact, if our universe was only one of those 10 to the 500 possibilities, it seems that we live in a very unlikely universe. Why on earth are we here? So we need, to some extent, a notion of measure in the landscape or dynamics within the landscape. So this brings us to the standard answer to that question is the anthropic argument. So this is Copernicus, who, if you like, is the father of this notion. But more recently, you might talk about Steven Weinberg, Brandon Carter. I gave this talk in Cambridge, and there was people shouting about that. Probably I should have put Brandon Carter there, but anyway. But basically, the idea goes is that only a universe like our own, like we see around us, would have the right conditions.
Von Dicke.
Another one?
And Brandon Carter.
Okay.
And there's other people who fight about not being a
scientist. Yeah. Of course, you've only got one slide, right? So well, just to put your favourite person there, or your least favourite person there, however you choose to look at it, and then.
You know, I'm a little surprised by Copernicus. I thought that he had invented the Copernican principle, which was going to make us quite special.
Well, yeah. Okay. That's true. But okay. Anyway, let's.
But you're the first one to complain that his picture was there.
Right. Yeah, no one's complained about Copernicus yet. Everyone complains about this one. Anyway.
He hasn't complained yet.
Right. So I'll choose Weinberg. You can put whoever you want. But the point is, the argument goes the same, right? It's that basically only universe that is like our own would have the right conditions for intelligent observers to evolve. And loosely speaking, the key points are that if you had a cosmological constant that was too large and positive, then the universe would have expanded too fast for structures to form. And conversely, if the universe were too large, and if the cosmological constant were too large and negative, then the universe would have collapsed before structures had the chance to form. Now, as Andy Sultan says, not everybody likes this. And in a sense, this explanation is sort of inherently unscientific in the point that it doesn't really predict anything. It can't really be falsified. It doesn't mean it's wrong, it just means it's in some sense unscientific. So what we really need is ideally would be some sort of measure of probability within the landscape. So we can answer the question, do we live in a probable universe? And it's certainly true that an alternative to anthropic selection would be desirable. So really, obviously that's very difficult. We don't know very much about non-perturbative string theory, what we need to sort of basically be able to map the landscape properly. But we can sort of ask questions about dynamics within the landscape, which is what Henry Tyers tried to do. So I want to talk about resonant tunneling and quantum mechanics. So what is this phenomenon? Okay, so I want you to imagine a double barrier in quantum mechanics. So as you know, the probability of tunneling through a single barrier is always exponentially suppressed. Okay. However, if I've got a situation like this where I have a double barrier, so my probability of tunneling through from here to here, exponentially suppressed. My probability of tunneling from here to here, exponentially suppressed. You might think that my probability of tunneling from here through to here is also exponentially suppressed. It normally is, right? But if conditions are right, actually the probability of tunneling straight through in one go can be of order 1. Now, I haven't really explained what I mean by conditions are right. I will shortly. But this phenomenon is what's known as resonant tunneling. And as I said, it has been seen in semiconductors. So Henry Tai noticed this and asked, what if something similar happens in the landscape? So here we have sort of a picture of the landscape. It's only got three, not 10 to the 500 vacua, but let's not worry about that. And we've got three vacua, A, B, and C. Now again, the probability of tunneling between any two adjacent vacua is suppressed, so tunneling from A to B is suppressed, tunneling from B to C is suppressed. Again, you would imagine that if you tunneled from A all the way through to C, that probability would just be the product of the other two. two intermediate ones, and that would also be suppressed. But then what if something like resonant tunneling occurs here and conditions are right, whatever that means, you have some sort of resonance effect and actually the tunneling from A to C is of order one. So one question that you might ask is, what is meant by conditions are right in the context of the landscape? So let's suppose something like this does happen. What does this mean for the landscape? Well, I want you to imagine that you start out in some very vacuum with a very high vacuum energy, large and positive. Okay, now if that's where you live, then there's a whole bunch of vacua with lower vacuum energy beneath. Go.
So many people like to start this way, and I don't want to slow you off in your talk, but do you have a reason for that?
For why you should start at with a high vacuum energy?
But my own theory is that we're very, very simple-mindedly copying over. We all learn big bangs in grad school. We all know the universe begins with high energy.
Yeah.
So we just do that.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, has nothing to do with what you really might expect in the landscape. But
okay, so, well, one...
But it's okay.
Okay,
you're in good company.
Yeah. Well, okay, so one answer is that I might have given would be that one, which you don't like. Another one you might say is, well, I don't know, if I start off at a low energy vacuum, is my job done? Do I have to? Because tunneling up is always much harder than tunneling down. So one could argue that, perhaps. So this is like, if you like, the worst case scenario. So, I don't know. I think...
Maybe we can talk about it for longer.
Yeah, I think it's a philosophical point of some sense. But okay, let's sort of do that. Let's imagine that this is the scenario. We start out with some high energy vacuum, then there's lots of vacuum beneath us. Okay, and lots of vacuum, tends to, almost a continuum. So that means there's a lots of tunneling paths going down to lower energy vacuum. And you would naively expect that if you've got so many, that at least one of these, if resonant paths exist, since there's so many paths, that at least one of them will correspond to a resonant path. And if that's the case, well, what happens? If you see a resonant path, you go down it because the probability of tunneling through it is order one. So down you go. Okay, and that happens with the probability of order unity. Now, the point is that once you get down to, you go through one tunneling path, then you ask, are there any more tunneling paths beneath me? The answer is either yes or no. If it's yes, you go down it, and you keep doing that. You cascade down these resonant paths until eventually you find that there's none beneath you. And when you're going to find that there's none beneath you, well, you're going to find there's none beneath you when you've got to a much, much lower vacuum. This argument does assume there are no ADS vacuum.
Can I just ask one small technical question?
Yeah.
So if you want to tunnel from one vacuum high to one vacuum low fast,
yeah,
why don't they just put basically a very small barrier and a low barrier in between? I mean, who cares about resonance? I mean, is there some point why they actually prefer to go to a resonance instead of simply just postulating their,
Well, I think the point is that. So.
Or is it an issue of some argument that in fact the landscape is unstable? I mean, this could be.
I don't think this could solve the problem, the cosmological constant problem, by maybe the landscape is such that you do that.
I think the point is if the landscape has so much richness and variety, and resonant paths can exist, then they will exist. And if they exist, you can't avoid. You follow them. There's no.
I'm not sure why would that help you with the small vacuum energy and giving you a consistent.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
So why would that?
So why would that help you? Why would it be so much superior? How would that help you with getting a small residual vacuum energy?
Okay, so I think the point is that it doesn't have to be resonant tunneling. Any kind of enhanced tunneling mechanism to take you from high to low would do just as well. Okay, so. Tai, as you know, but any kind of enhanced small barriers.
I guess I'm not going to bother you because you need to go, but I don't understand that because, in internal inflation, if you at least adopt that point of view, however slow the tunneling is, as long as you have one vacuum with the right residual, you just think. So someplace you will be right, and then you use anthropic argument.
But this is trying to avoid anthropic arguments, in the sense that.
Okay.
You could argue you're pushing the anthropic argument, sort of sweeping onto the carpet in some sense, because you're using the fact that they exist, the paths must exist. That's how the anthropic argument gets shifted into that zone. But it's at least adding some dynamics to it. And it does sort of naturally give you the possibility of going to.
I can see how this something like this could change probability.
Yes.
Getting in the okay. Alright. Perhaps that's
what. So a simpler statement is just that you better understand this if you're gonna understand probabilities in the landscape. Right?
I don't think you can say. Yeah, I mean yeah.
This changes the measure of the final state.
Absolutely, yeah. But I think the point is that so this was all speculation. I think when we first came across this, we thought, well, this is a bit of a leap of faith here. And so I think resonant tunneling might not even be possible.
Yes.
In quantum field theory. And if it's not, then this is irrelevant. Forget about this argument. So there's a question.
Maybe sort of related, it's not exactly clear to me yet why this helps. I mean, is there any reason to think that out of all the local literature that have properties that resemble outer world, that they are at lower?
No, I mean, no, this is just dealing with a cosmological constant. Yeah, this is just trying to get from low to low cosmological constant. No, I'm not. This doesn't tell you anything about whether I'm going to pick up the right, I don't know, small neutrino masses, whatever, all the various different bits and bobs that you want to have in our universe. No, it doesn't deal with that. But it deals with one big problem, which is, well, it attempts to deal with one big problem, which is the cosmological constant problem, in some sense. But it doesn't solve everything. No. Right, carry on. Yeah. Okay, so there is an assumption here that there's no ADS vacuum. But you kind of need to resort to some sort of anthropic argument to avoid that. But this is what was presented. Okay. So maybe this explains why you have such a small vacuum energy. But it only explains it if resonant paths do exist in the landscape, or even in quantum field theory. So that's the question that we want to ask. Can such a thing happen in the landscape? Is it even possible? So to address that question, well, let's ask, can such a thing happen in quantum field theory? If it's not going to happen in quantum field theory, it seems highly unlikely it's going to happen in the landscape. Okay? And an even simpler question is, can it happen in n-dimensional quantum mechanics? And remember, you just think of quantum field theory as the sort of infinite limit. So if we want to answer that question, we need to understand this next question, which is, how does it happen in quantum mechanics? We want to get some insight in that. We ask, how does it happen in optics? Okay, so we're making the problem simpler and simpler. We've managed to go from landscape to optics, which is actually something called GCSE physics. I realise I'm in the States here, so no one will know what GCSEs are. GCSEs are the exams you do in England when you're 16. They're far too easy now. They've dumbed them down big time, but they're much harder than I did them. Anyway, so let's do some GCSE physics, or whatever you call them over here. Okay, so total internal reflection. So hopefully everyone can remember that from some dark and distant past. So you have a glass prism surrounded by air, and you shine a light ray on it. Now, because the refractive index of glass is different from that of air, the critical angle is less than 90 degrees, and when the angle of incidence exceeds the critical angle, you get total internal reflection. This has an analogue in mechanics. We like to think of this as like reflection of a potential barrier in mechanics. Okay? So why am I talking about that? Well, okay. Now, I didn't do this in GCSEs. I don't know whether they do over here. But frustrated total internal reflection, what's that? Well, now you take two prisms and you put them very close together, but there is a little air gap between the two. Now, you'd imagine if you shone a light ray on this, then you would still get total internal reflection because it's still air on the other side, even though there's a prism, but there's still a gap of air. But actually, that's not quite what happens. You do get a transmitted ray, a much weakened transmitted ray. Essentially, what happens is you get this incident ray, and then at this barrier, you produce this sort of, it's called an evanescent wave, or something like that, wave, which is sort of exponentially damped. But if this gap is small enough, it can sort of creep into the other prism, and then you get this transmitted ray. So, This, you might see where I'm going with this, this has, again, an analog in quantum mechanics. This is like barrier penetration. Okay.
So what sets the scale?
Of the...
Yeah, of the amorphous.
I guess it must be something related to the wavelength of the... of the light ray. Right? I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Well, difference in the relative frequency in the indices of refraction must play a role.
Yeah. But to get a scale.
There'll be a number of things thrown in there. I don't know the details to go. But certainly if the gap's too big, you don't get detectable bit.
So basically you have an imaginary momentum. And something.
Yes, yes.
The momentum is fixed by the difference in the index of refraction.
Right. Okay, so anyway, so now I want to talk about the Fabry-Perot interferometer, which, okay, so now I've got a situation where I've got these two parallel partially silvered mirrors, and again, I'm going to shine a light ray on these. Now, these mirrors, the rays can either reflect or a little bit gets transmitted through, so much in the same way as with the prisms on the last slide. Now, when you have this sort of setup, something interesting can happen. If the transmitted rays, so the rays in this cavity here can sort of bounce around, and sometimes they'll go through, sometimes they'll bounce around. But the point is, if the transmitted rays are in phase with one another, then they interfere constructively, and the amplitude is enhanced of the transmitted ray. Now, this happens in a very particular situation, is when the cavity width is sort of these half-integer multiple of the wavelength. And it's this phenomenon which is the analog of resonant tunneling. Okay? So if you like, you've got like two barriers. You've got this sort of oscillatory situation in the middle, and then you get this constructive interference, and the amplitude gets enhanced. Okay. So that's the analog of optical analog.
So in terms of, if you can flip back to that for a second, there must be some transient behavior. You turn on your beam and it takes a while to come up to the higher amplitude, is that right?
I guess that there must be
so it's really kind of a building up of a time delay.
Yes,
sort of taking stuff out and putting it in later.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Is that
I think in the optical case that must be the case. Yeah. Because you do need these are great to build up and can start here. So it's obviously going to be the speed of light, it's not infinite.
Yeah, there must be some conservation of energy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's certainly true because
or maybe you start losing stuff.
No problem because you get destructive interference in your reflected waves when you get constructive.
But I think his point is that once you're doing so, you're getting this
wave. Oh, it's relative to the case where you're losing other light.
Yes.
Directions.
Yes.
It's relative to incoming.
But you do need
right. So you're simply taking a situation where you might have had losses.
Oh, you would do because these would
getting rid of those losses destructive. In one particular case and putting it all.
Yeah.
In one
place. Ordinarily, these two rays would be destructive, but
okay. So it's just really good transmission.
Yes. But it happens in this very particular case where and that's an important point actually. The cavity width has to be this m plus a half times the wavelength, which we'll see has an analog in resonant, and it's an analogous equation in the quantum mechanical case. Okay, so let's talk about quantum mechanics now. Now we have a particle of mass m and energy E, and we have this potential barrier. Okay, now classically a particle in this region A, if it's incident on this barrier, will turn around to this turning point here and just be reflected back. However, quantum mechanically we know that's not quite what happens. The situation is described by this Schrodinger equation and this wave function, and actually you can actually tunnel through from A through to this classically disconnected region B. Now how do we sort of deal with that on a technical level? Well, we use something called the WKB approximation, and we can describe the wave functions in the classically allowed region, for example, and it takes this sort of oscillatory form. So the classically allowed region here being defined where the energy is greater than potential. In the classically forbidden regions, which is in here, where the energy is less than potential, the wave function takes this exponential forms. Okay? So this is all very familiar stuff, hopefully. The point is that, okay, so the WKB approximation doesn't work very well close to the turning point, but there is a way to sort of connect the formulae sort of from here, in here, to in here, to in here. Okay? So you can actually connect the formulae right across the barrier. And the fact that you're able to do that enables you to sort of calculate the probability of tunnelling in this WKB approximation. And what you find is that the probability of tunnelling through from A to B is exponentially suppressed. Okay, it depends on this thing theta, okay, which essentially encodes the size and the width and the height of this barrier.
Oh, and cap is the square root of.
Sorry, yeah, that was on this. Yeah, that was on the. I mean, I can flip back, but yeah, that's right. Okay. So that's tunneling, exponentially suppressed. Resonant tunneling. What happens here? Well, okay. You play the same game. You have your WK. You have your forms for the wave function and the WKB approximation. You apply your connection formulae. So you apply connect here, connect here, connect here, connect here, connect here. You're able to connect right across the barrier. And what you find is that the probability of tunneling right across this barrier is given by this expression here. Now, just forget about the cos for a moment. Okay. We've got the theta, which essentially tells you about this barrier here. We've got phi, which is essentially telling you about this barrier here. And these both come in as exponential. So normally, this thing is exponentially suppressed, doubly exponentially suppressed, if you like. Okay, that seems intuitively consistent. But let's not forget that we've got this cos w here, which is essentially telling you about, the w tells you about this little central well. Now, if you look at our expression, you can see that okay, if cos w is of order 1, then nothing changes. But what happens is, as cos w goes to 0, well, you can see that this tunnelling probability clearly starts to blow up. It goes above 1, which you might say, well, what does that mean? Well, it doesn't really mean anything that it goes above 1. What it's telling us is that there is enhancement. And you can actually use a slight use of the connection formula and actually get that this starts to approach 1. You include sign contributions and things. But the point is that clearly you're getting some enhancement as cos w goes towards 0, and that corresponds to this when w is m plus a half pi. So see that m plus a half again. Okay?
Wait till you're
done. Okay, so actually this isn't Bohr's Sommerfeld. I think that's we got the words wrong there. But this is like a quantization condition which corresponds to the existence of a bound state in this central well. Okay, it's exactly what that condition gives you.
Where are the limits of integration of your picture?
They go between the turning points. Yeah. Okay, so now you see that the width of B is roughly m plus half times the Broglie wavelength. And so the point is that you can see the analog with the optical scenario.
Can I think of this as you're tuning everything so that you come in and you have your suppression in one barrier, but then you latch onto the growing?
Perhaps we'll see really why it happens.
And I think when you say bound state in the middle, that kind of tells me that, because then that's a symmetrical thing that's going to.
Yeah, I guess that there's an bound in that. It's really, the key is constructive interference.
Right.
That's what's really happening, which you'll see.
Well, the easy way to see it, I would think, would be to look at the reflected wave, where you have the reflection from the first barrier and the reflection from the second barrier. And if those two interfere destructively, then by conservation probability,
be aware of all the various connection forms and any applicability of them. You have to be slightly subtle, but this is the sort of picture I want to emphasize now of why it happens. Okay, so basically, this bound state corresponds to a particle oscillating between two turning points in this central region. So, what's actually happening is you can imagine all the different sort of contributions to the path integral. You've got this thing going straight through, then you get this thing bouncing, 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 and when all these things interfere constructively, that's precisely when you get the resonance effect. Okay, so basically, as it's oscillating, it's picking up a quantum phase, and if this phase is exactly this value, you get this constructive interference, and you get resonance. So these are the key points that I want to take away from this. Is the existence of a classical solution in the middle, which oscillates between two stationary points. That's absolutely essential to this, for this resonance effect to work. And the other point is that the quantum phase it picks up should be m plus half pi. Okay? They're the key points. So now let's try and extend this to n-dimensional quantum mechanics. So I want to think of quantum field. The reason I'm looking at this, I want to think of quantum field theory as the n goes to infinity limit. So let's just consider the mechanics of a particle of unit mass in n dimensions. And classically, we know that the path of the particle is just given by this thing q, which is found by extremizing the action. Okay, quantum mechanically, however, this is described by a wave function. And that satisfies the Schrödinger equation. So I think it's very familiar there. So this is now the sort of higher dimensional analog of what we had earlier. It's all very, hopefully, very familiar. So we can now try and apply the WKB approximation to this scenario, and actually we immediately run into difficulties, and the reason we run into difficulties in this higher dimensional scenario is that we have ambiguity in the direction of this gradient. Okay, and this creates a little bit of a technical problem. However, this was resolved a few decades ago now by Banks, Benjamin, and Wu. And what they suggest was to reduce the problem to essentially one-dimensional quantum mechanics by restricting attention to these classical paths in most problems. can fluctuate around them, but you basically reduce the problem to one-dimensional quantum mechanics along these classical paths and most probable escape paths, and I'll explain what they are shortly. Classical path is sort of self-explanatory, really, but... So let's discuss what they are. So I want you to think of the n-dimensional space as being split into sort of classically allowed regions and classically forbidden regions. So you think of this sort of like a mountain range, right? If you're on top of the mountain, you're in a classically allowed region. If you're inside the mountain, you're in a classically forbidden region. Okay, so a classical path. In the classically allowed region, the classical path is where the wave function is peaked. Okay, that makes sense. That's essentially what we mean. So where the wave function is peaked, that's the classical path. Okay. That seems fairly familiar, but what's the analogue of that in the forbidden regions? Well, in the forbidden regions, it's again, you just say, where is the wave function peaked? Okay, where's the dominant behaviour occurring? And it occurs, there are paths where the wave function is peaked. And we call these paths the most probable escape paths. So the way I like to think of these is if you imagine the mountain range, it's like the path through the mountain where the rock is at its most soft. If you want to tunnel through that mountain, you go through the path where the rock is softest and it's easiest to tunnel through. Those are the most probable escape paths. Those are where they're the analog of the classical paths in the forbidden regions. Okay, so here's the mathematical definition. So apologies for this. It's a little bit dry, but it's kind of, well... I have to do it, so you can do it as well. Okay, so just as a formal definition, so you just consider a path in R to the M, which is parameterized by lambda, and you have a tangent vector along that path, and you have n-1 orthogonal normal vectors. So the formal definition of a classical path or a most probable escape path is that the gradient along the normal directions should vary. So this is sigma here, that should be psi. Sigma is that's really coming from sigma, actually is e to the psi is e to the sigma, but so it's essentially equivalent. But anyway, the point is that the gradient of the wave function should vanish along these normal directions. That's all we mean. But this turns out to be a very restrictive condition. Okay, what this actually tells you is that the classical path should satisfy this equation. This is a typo here. So notice this morning that should be grad V there. But it tells you the classical path should satisfy that equation. So you recognise that lambda is like playing the role of real time in the classical region. And the proper distance along the curve is defined like so. And in the semi-classical approximation, the wave function is essentially dominated by its value close to the classical path. And you can show that it takes this sort of as before, because essentially reduced the problem to one of quantum mechanics along the path, you get this oscillatory form for the wave function there. The most probable escape path it's basically you play the same game, but you play in the forbidden region. And now you get a slight sign change in the equation that the most popular escape path should satisfy. So remember, the only condition we applied here was that the wave function was peaked. Now lambda plays the role of imaginary time. And again, the wave function is dominated by its value close to the typo. That should be the most probable escape path. And now you get the exponential growing and damping part, as before. It's all very analogous.
So is this just basically a steepest descent approximation to the path integral?
Yeah, exactly.
And the factor in front is the
Fedora. Yeah. All that sort of thing. And you can consider fluctuations about this as well,
yeah.
But I'm not going to discuss that.
Well, you've already
integrated
out the first
function. Yeah. Okay, so I want to introduce the notion of the tunneling highway now. So what we've done is we've n-dimensional quantum mechanics has essentially been reduced to one-dimensional quantum mechanics along what I'm going to call the tunneling highway. Now, the tunneling highway is this combination of classical paths and most probable escape paths that are involved in any given tunneling process. Now, if you've just got one barrier, then the tunneling highway is just one most probable escape path, that's it. Okay, but if you've got a number of barriers, then you can see how you have to have a most probable escape path, and then a classical path, and then a most probable escape path, and so on. And you've got to sort of sew these together. So we sew these you sew them together at the classical turning points. Okay? And I'm going to just generically call that combination the tunneling highway. So pictorially, consider this as your n-dimensional space. Okay, so the red regions are the classically forbidden regions, and the green regions are the classically allowed regions. And I want to imagine that I'm tunneling from this classically allowed region to that one there, C. Now you can see there's going to be various ways I can do this. I can either go direct. Okay, this is one way. What I have here is one most probable escape path. My tunneling highway corresponds to just that one path. Okay, that's going to be exponentially suppressed, that transition. However, I could sort of go on what might seem to be like a long and winding road via B. Okay, so now I have sort of two barriers, two most probable escape paths, and I've sewn them onto this classical path en route. Okay. That's the sort of picture that. So you can see how the tunneling highway can the various paths that you might like to take. Okay, so now let's make the leap to quantum field theory. So let's consider the standard theory of a scalar field. It's just evolving in time through some spatial volume and under the influence of some potential. It's described by that classical action. And I want to think of this field as describing a quantum mechanical system in infinite dimensional space. So I basically take the field at each point in space, and that's like another quantum mechanical degree of freedom. Okay, that's just a technical point. So the wave function describing this now is a functional acting on the fields phi. Okay, now these phis basically exist in some sort of appropriate configuration. So it's a functional acting on some configuration space. What is this configuration space? Well, it contains the fields phi, it's just a space of real valued functions on the volume. Okay, satisfying some boundary condition. So just to get an intuitive idea, a classical path now would be parameterized by time, but it takes you, at one point in time, it has some configuration 5x. At another point in time, it has another configuration 5 something else of x. Okay, and you go through all these different configurations of the sort of of their functions phi, okay.
And the only reason you get to think that way is that you've limited yourself to these highways. And the evolution. I mean,
at this stage, I'm not mentioning the highway.
But
this is just a path integral. This is each of those paths is just a history.
Yeah. But this is really just a sort of I'm sort of formalizing what I really mean by this statement.
But in a Schrodinger picture, you wouldn't even get to talk about that kind of evolution. You fix the time.
Yes, so you consider, there's no time in the configuration space. That's an important point. The time is the path
evolution
through it.
Doesn't even look classical. So
Time evolution is the path through the space, taking you through different configurations. That's how.
Which in general isn't a way you can think quantum mechanics.
It's an unusual way to view it, but it's the, if you want to try and understand resonant tunneling, it's kind of the way you have to suddenly get some sort of Schrodinger-like equation. You need to get some sort of analog of the Schrodinger equation, which is what I'm going to do. So we're describing this by a wave function in this appropriate space. The norm of that wave function measures the probability density for a given configuration in that space. So thinking of this way, we can sort of formally do this, but what we end up with is a generalized form of the Schrodinger equation in terms of functional derivatives. And it takes this form here. Now, the key ingredient here that I want to point out is that the potential that appears in this equation isn't V, essentially. It's some sort of generalized potential, which includes a contribution coming from the gradient. And I think that's important, because what you might naively, you might look at a certain potential in some ways, which is what Ty did, and say, oh, that looks like it might be able to realize resonance or something. But actually, that may bear no resemblance to the form of U. They could be completely different. It's very difficult to tell just by looking at it whether the two are related. So but that's an important technical point. Okay, so we now split configuration space, whatever that is, this space of functions, into classically allowed regions and classically forbidden regions, whereas now the sort of boundary of that is this potential U. And as before, in the classically allowed region, the wave function is peaked along classical paths. In the classically forbidden region, it's peaked along most probable escape paths.
But no, that depends on the gradient of phi. So it's dependent.
No, it's the gradient of psi.
Okay.
Yeah. That's how you, it's. Okay. There's a whole functional language that you have to apply to this. It's the gradient of psi. Okay. So again, a classical path is now a path in configuration space. So it's defined at each point in the volume, okay, and we get taken through configuration space by this parameter lambda. Okay. Now, when you apply the arguments of the fact that the wave function should be peaked, psi that is, then you find that this path phi satisfies something which very much resembles the classical equations of motion. Okay, where lambda is now playing the role of real time.
So x here, though, is the set of all coordinates, right?
X.
So the d squared by dx squared is really rad squared?
Okay, yeah, so I've just done this in one dimension, but yeah,
okay.
if you could generalize it.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
And, yeah. It's just the notational simplicity.
Yeah, okay.
And also
just trying to make sure I understood
that. Yeah, that's probably a bit. Yeah, I should have written that a bit more carefully. Okay, so in the semi classical approximation, again, play the same game as before, the wave function is peaked by its value close to the maybe opposite of the state of the should be classical now. Too much cut and paste in there. And you get this sort of oscillatory form again. Do the same things with the most probable escape paths. You demand that the wave function is peaked. Okay, so again, the path is defined at each point. It's not a path, this important point, it's not a path through V. It's not a path through here, it's a path through configuration space. Okay, and again, when you demand that the wave function is peaked, you find that it satisfies the Euclidean equations of motion. Okay, and lambda is now playing the role of imaginary time. And you get this sort of exponentially growing and damping part of the wave function.
So, a path through configuration space is the history, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess that's right, yeah. Yeah, that's probably the,
okay.
That's right. Okay, so now we consider what is required for resonant tunneling in quantum field theory. We're now getting in a position to answer this. So I'm going to consider a generic potential here. Notice I haven't got a double barrier here, but I don't know whether I need a double barrier or not, because this is V. It's U I really need to worry about. Not U, U. Okay, so what we know is we can reduce the problem to quantum mechanics along the tunneling highway. This is a tunneling highway in configuration space. And again, the effective potential that we need to think about is U rather than V. Now, for resonance to occur, we need a double barrier along the highway. We know that. We reduced the problem to quantum mechanics along that direction, so we know if we want resonance, we want a double barrier along that highway. So that means the highway must contain at least two most probable escape paths, and it'd be separated by a classical path, which is like a central well.
But here the highway is in this huge dimensional space.
Yes, it is, yeah.
So whereas we think of a highway as a linear thing, this isn't a linear...
Well, it's a one-dimensional
collection
path through the air.
So the
it's on a surface.
Oh wait, what's one-dimensional, though?
Well, it's only parameterized by the one parameter lambda, yeah. It's defined at each point, but it's a path in configuration space. Yeah. So the point is that whatever these things are, that you have to have two most probable escape paths, and you have to have this central well if you're going to get resonance. So and the key ingredients are the properties of this classical path in the centre. Okay, and must correspond to something like this Baron state solution, where you've got a solution that's oscillating between two stationary points and picking up this quantum phase. Okay, so let's look at the standard scenario, which is the decay of a...
For every mode, right?
For every mode.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
guess that's going to be the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, essentially, yeah, because we're going to be integrating it. Okay, so let's look at the decay of the homogeneous force vacuum. Standard scenario. This is configuration space. Okay. I'm going to look at that sort of path because that's got two double barriers. Okay. Now, where am I going to start? I'm going to start with the false vacuum everywhere. I equals zero everywhere. That's the standard picture. Where do I end up? I end up with the bounce solution. So we have this bubble of true vacuum in the false vacuum, expanding ball. Standard scenario. If you went straight from here to here, you'd have your standard Coleman tunneling scenario. But we're not going to choose that path in configuration space. We're choosing this other one. What's this? What could this intermediate bound state be? Well, when we first looked at this, we thought, well, maybe, okay, what could be a suitable candidate? We thought maybe an oscillon. So for those that don't know what an oscillon is, it's essentially, it's just a field theory configuration where the field oscillates between sort of two values. Okay? So you do have this situation where you have these stationary, the field is everywhere stationary at various points in time. Okay? So typically these things are approximate solutions.
What are you oscillating in time?
Yes. Yeah, so this
so
sort of the field
stationary in points in time.
So if you imagine like the field, let's just think of it as a radial profile of the field, then it might have, typically you make them sort of like have this sort of this type of,
so that's R.
And yeah, so this is R, yeah, and this would be phi, so it's asymptoting over to phi equals zero, and then this thing can move as time evolves. And it might do various things, right? And it just oscillates. This is an oscillator. So there are very few exact solutions known, but there's a number of approximate ones known, and they've been shown to be very long-lived. And you can sort of see how these standard things might have the right kind of properties. These sort of, it looks a bit like a bound state. It's oscillating between two points. So it seems that if resonance tunneling is possible, then these will play a role. Okay, so this is another important point is that the field, you shouldn't think of the field as basically going from A to B and then to C. It doesn't work like that. It really is going directly to C, and it just uses B as a springboard, if you like. That's the way I like to think of it.
I'm not sure that sentence means anything.
Well, what I'm trying to emphasise is that you don't sort of tunnel from A to B and then sit there for a bit. Okay.
So it's some solution that covers the whole thing.
Yeah. Okay. So the key point is that it's the properties of this bound state. This everything really sort of boils down to this. So if you want to decay the vacuum to decay by resonant tunneling, what properties does this bound state have to satisfy this the field in this central well? Well, we came up with five things that we thought were reasonable things that it should satisfy. The first is that it should be a solution to the classical field equations. They'll take that as read, right? It's a classical path. It's a solution to the classical field equations. That's what it is. It shouldn't be the false vacuum. Why not? Because it's at a different point in configuration space. Okay. It should have zero energy. Why is this? This is just energy conservation, right? This is zero energy defined relative to the false vacuum. The initial state was the homogeneous false vacuum that had zero energy. So every other point in configuration space, we want to have zero energy as well. Okay? So not in configuration space. Any other solution should also have zero energy. It should have the same boundary conditions as the false vacuum. It essentially should asymptote to the false vacuum. That seems reasonable from the point of view of finite energy considerations as well. And basically, this is this other key ingredient, is that there should exist two points where the field is everywhere stationary. Okay, and this enables us to sew the ingoing most probable escape path onto the outgoing one. Okay, this is going to be a very restrictive condition. And finally, if miracles happen, you can actually get all four of these reasonable conditions to be satisfied. You then need to impose that this Bohr-Sundwall quantization condition holds. And if that does hold, then you've got resonance. So now here's our no-go thing. Can such a bound state exist? Okay, so there's the five conditions. So let's take condition two, zero energy. The solution has zero energy. That's what we mean by that. It's fairly straightforward. Now, the action does not explicitly depend on space, so that we can actually find, this is like the analog of the Hamiltonian, we can actually show that this integral is everywhere constant. Straightforward. It's the analog of the Hamiltonian, but for x rather than t.
I'm stuck on number three. Maybe you can just help me catch up with you. So if I'm thinking back to the quantum case, these classical solutions live inside the little
valve. Right.
And saying it asymptotes to the false vacuum,
well,
I'm thinking that means it has to asymptote to something on the other side of the valve.
So each configuration is the configuration itself is defined at every configuration. In that configuration space, asymptotes the false vacuum. Now, why do I want that?
There's never tunnel.
No, you do tunnel because let's take another configuration.
Then the rest of the transition happens classically.
So let's consider another configuration which asymptotes the false vacuum. The bounce asymptotes the false vacuum. The final state, it's just an expanded ball, but in the infinite.
So you're sort of following that picture and just enhancing it with this resonance.
Yeah. So I mean, there's issues with finite charges and things like that.
Right.
Asymptote,
not in time but in space.
Yes, sorry.
That's what mistake has made.
Yeah.
Okay,
so the spatial, okay. the time crops in here, so
yes.
It has to be stationary.
Gotcha.
So yeah, asymptotically in space. Sorry, yeah. But configuration space only really defined over space. The function over space. Time is the path through the configuration.
And so it's not an issue we had in the quantum case. This asymptote.
It's not a problem. It doesn't
exist.
Prevent tunneling.
It wasn't an issue.
It's nothing to prevent tunneling because I mean, you can still have common tunneling because you just tunnel to this bounce.
But in the one-dimensional quantum mechanics.
Oh no, it's
not.
No, good, very good point. Very good point. Yeah, that's the key.
This is asymptoting in some way that we haven't even.
That's the new thing. It's an essential new ingredient that wasn't an issue for quantum mechanics. Absolutely true. That's absolutely right. So the point is. You can actually, so this is what you wouldn't be. So this is a key point now. What you've just said. This next bit of the argument you can't do for quantum mechanics. Okay. So what you say is right. Well, I can construct this integral. The action doesn't depend on space. So I can construct this integral I, which is everywhere constant. And now I say, well, it's everywhere constant. I should evaluate it at the boundary, the spatial boundary. Okay. Well, the spatial boundary is just the false vacuum. So I evaluate this, and it's zero. So it's everywhere zero. Now, I couldn't have done that in the quantum mechanical case, right? But I can here. So now I take these two to the energy in this thing I, and I sort of take certain integrals, and I take them away from one another, and I can actually construct this thing. And this is rather nice, because what this tells me is that at all points in space and at all points in time, this thing, d phi by dt and d phi by dx, has got to vanish. And if it vanishes at all points in space and all points in time, and it is asymptotically zero, it's everywhere, zero, all points in space and all points in time. So it really is just the false vacuum. But it's not allowed to be the false vacuum, because that's a different point in configuration space. It also fails this condition. So that's it. We can't do it. We can't satisfy all five conditions. So what have we shown? We've shown how quantum field theory can be reduced to quantum mechanics along the tunneling highway. We've shown that for the analogue of resonant tunneling to occur, we need this oscillating solution, this bound state. That's really the key ingredient. And for the decay of the homogeneous false vacuum, this solution must satisfy these five conditions, which are very well motivated. No such solution exists. This means the homogeneous false vacuum cannot decay by resonant tunneling in standard scalar quantum field theory. And this is the thing that you normally look at, right? So now...
So I'm getting the feeling this is something that if it were in a finite box, there would be some residual.
Yeah, there things get more subtle.
So then it would sort of have to be non-local.
Yeah, I think if you're in a box... If you're in a box, then you can maybe ask questions about what your boundary conditions.
Yeah,
you
so
can,
that's
you
what
can
I
play
mean,
with
yeah.
that, yeah, and
yeah,
maybe
it's
get.
Really this, I mean, the only reason you need these boundary conditions is that space is infinite and you can't afford.
That could be one avenue which you could possibly think about
action.
About evading this theorem. Okay, but as it stands, the theorem is a theorem. It holds. Given the axioms, it holds. Okay.
But also, assuming some sort of continuity.
I guess so, yeah.
I think so. Getting from that integral being zero.
Yes, there'll be something. There will be, simply connectedness, all this sort of. I imagine there's various things we should.
Well, this is supposed to be. This is supposed to be a classical.
Right, but if you write down a path integral where there isn't a classical path between your initial and final points, that doesn't mean that the path integral is zero.
No, but
you
I mean,
have to work harder.
Well, if I want to describe the analog of resonant
right.
tunneling,
yes.
then I've got to have it.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, but then I'm doing something else. Okay. So, but I want to think about what does this mean for the landscape then? So, well, does this mean we can't have it in the landscape? Well, we can do various things. We can try various things, like you suggested, put it in a box, maybe think things like that. Go beyond WKB, I have no way I'm going to do that. You could consider non-standard scalar field theories. Clearly, the subtlety of the way I was playing around with those integrals only really works for that case. So the proof only really works for standard scalar quantum field theories. Include gravity. I can't see how that's going to help, because the key here is all about constructive interference. This is liable to spoil that.
Well, your energy is
there's all sorts of.
So, I don't know what will happen.
But I think I mean the way we were thinking of it is you'd have issues with Hubble damping, spoiling the interference. So the interference might work for a bit and then it gets spoiled and things like that. And gauge theories, you might consider them. There's issues with asymptotics there. You can play a bit more general there. Other enhanced tunneling mechanisms, Tai's been looking at various things like that. I'm not going to go into that. But what I briefly mention is relaxing some of our conditions. How can you justifiably relax some of our conditions? So there's the conditions. So you might relax this one, stationarity at the turning points. Now, this is something that you can allow non-vanishing momenta at transition points. Now, this requires you starting to go to complex momenta, and this is something that. That Ruth Gregory and Peter Pocock did years ago. It's not very standard, but that might be something you might wish to consider. Another thing is asymptotes to the false vacuum. Can you break that? Well, you can alter the spatial boundary conditions, perhaps in the way that Andy mentioned, or you could, Hawking Moss, for example, everywhere tunnels at once. That includes gravity, right? So what effect that's going to have? But what I want to emphasise here is. I want to break the zero energy condition. Okay, and this, you might think of this as looking at the decay of an inhomogeneous initial state. I've only got two more slides to go. So. So we're going to rather than considering the K of the homogeneous state, we're going to consider K of an inhomogeneous state. So how's that going to work? So very briefly, I want to consider a theory with two false vacua A and B and one true vacuum C. So perhaps generically taking this sort of form, I'm going to impose that all states asymptote to B. Just to be definite about what I'm doing. Now, the initial state is going to be an inhomogeneous. Before, we were just looking at the initial state as being just B. Okay, and we know there's no tunneling. There's no resonant tunneling. There is tunneling, no resonant tunneling. Now, I want to consider an initial state which is sort of a mixture of these two, okay, but still asymptotes to B. So, in a sense, it's like a bubble of A in B. Okay? Now, I want it to be a collapsing bubble. Now, the reason I want it to be a collapsing bubble, if it's an expanding bubble, it's just going to go on expanding. Okay, and if it goes on expanding, there's no way it's going to be stationary. There's no way I can sew it onto a most probable escape path. So what I want is a scenario where I have a collapsing bubble and it reaches some critical radius and then turns around. And at that point it turns around, I'm going to sew it onto an escape path. Okay, so I want a tunnel from this. This is a very contrived scenario. So this is the point. This I accept completely here. Right, this is a very contrived situation. And perhaps we should be taking something from this that you really do have to consider these very unusual situations to get anything to work. And then, so you tunnel from this very contrived setup to the standard case of an expanding bubble of C asymptoting to D. Okay, so that's the scenario I want to look at. Question is this resonant? Okay, so this is the picture. I've got this bubble of A and B. I'm going to this final state of a bubble of C and B, and I've got this intermediate bound state. This is the scenario I want. Is it an oscillon? It turns out it is going to be an oscillon.
So you've solved the asymptotic problem by kind of folding that out.
Well, we've still got the asymptotics. That's not the condition we've broken. The condition we've broken is the condition of zero energy. We'll see on the next slide sort of how that changes the conditions, how what we're doing changes the conditions. So as I said, we thought that the oscillons were going to play a role. It turns out that this bound state will be an oscillon. These are the conditions we had before. I said we're going to break this one, the zero energy. Now that we've got an inhomogeneous initial state, this changes, and it should have. The bound state should now have the same energy as the initial state, which is no longer zero because it's got this inhomogeneous, it's got this bubble in there. Okay? So given that, can we find a suitable bound state? The answer is the no-go theorem doesn't apply. We can. It turns out we can find suitable bound states. And that they are, in fact, oscillons. Turns out they are oscillons. So there was a specific example of this. In this, we were able to find exact solutions for this very special case. Essentially states asymptote to 5 or 0, and you can get tunneling, resonant tunneling going from bubbles of negative 5 to bubbles of positive 5. It's essentially sort of generically the same sort of picture as what I described earlier. Now this is just to give you a picture. This is a graph of the transmission probability, and what you can see is that for certain energy ranges, which corresponds to sort of certain sizes of bubbles, you really do get these enhanced transition rates, these discrete values, and they match exactly. So this is as far as we're aware is the first example of resonant tunneling quantum field theory, albeit a very contrived one. What does this mean for lessons of the last slide now? What does this mean for the landscape? Well, it's far from generic, no doubt about that. Okay, what we've shown is very contrived. We expect that it probably is going to get spoiled by gravity. You've got issues with bubble damping I mentioned earlier. We're looking at contracting bubbles, throwing gravity. Are these going to collapse? Maybe. If they do, then you're not going to get the turnaround that you need. Finite temperature is liable to spoil it. It's in the optical analogues. The resonances get broadened by finite temperature. But you could argue that in the spirit of the landscape, even the most contrived setup may be realised. Okay, then have we really gained anything by looking at this? I don't know. But what we have shown is that it's very, very hard to do. It's by far from generic. Standard tunneling scenarios that you would choose to look at don't follow these resonant paths. So I think, well, I'll leave it there. But anyway. The outlook is gloomy. Yeah, okay.
So you got this to work by violating the energy, zero energy. And if I think about the origin of that zero energy in your earlier piece, it was really had to do with assuming kind of infinite time in the initial.
Not so much infinite.
So, but what if you say, I tunnel in, and then I'm in some excited state because I've tunneled not to the ground state, but to some, some state with some energy, and then I use that energy to make a different statement.
Sure.
And can all that propagate through?
Okay, so what we did to begin with, we looked at just the standard picture of tunneling. What you normally look at.
It's an assumption about.
It's the simplest case. It's clear that you that you can consider more general scenarios. I mean, if you think about it, the universe isn't empty.
Being more conservative, I can say once I start cascading, I enter each vacuum not in the ground state but in some.
But what you could argue,
energy.
But what you could argue is that you've had to tunnel by conventional Kolmogorov methods
for the first step.
For
only.
The first step, well, that's going to be suppressed. You're losing what you gain, really. If you're going to do that, then.
I don't think so, because I think you drew this picture where the ball's sitting at the top, and aside from my gripes about that, let's go with it.
Yeah.
And so the ball's on the top.
It moves one
it's
step.
Everyone grants you an exponential decay rate to get out of there.
Well, not if you've got resonance. That's the point.
So I'm accepting your argument that you've got to have an exponential decay rate to take your first step.
Yes, okay.
And after that, everything's dynamical,
yeah.
And there's no zero energy condition.
Tunneled,
you've got some energy. I'm not convinced that's going to be enough, but it is a different. It's taking the point you made at the end and trying to fit it with this.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point.
And I'm curious.
I think that's a fair point.
How close that is to working.
I think that's a fair point. I think Ty's original motivation was to dispense with that suppression at all.
If every cosmological picture inherits the same exponential suppression, then they're all equal footing. It doesn't exactly lose anything.
Exactly. And I think the other thing that worries me a little bit about, so this example that we gave, it is so special. Right? You have this situation of the contracting bubble. And to actually get a cascade, then you actually need, what we figured out was that you would need a situation where you didn't tunnel to an expanding bubble, because if you tunnel to an expanding bubble, you don't tunnel out anything. That's the effect maybe locally. You perhaps want to convert, go to an oscillating type situation. So you tunnel to an oscillating type situation. So rather than tunneling, if you wanted to extend this setup to have a series of cascades, then it's not good to have the outstate to be the expanding bubble, because it doesn't generate, it doesn't stop it, essentially. It just starts expanding, keeps expanding. How are you going to sew that on?
To use the
so we were saying, well, perhaps you could sew onto it. Maybe you could tunnel to an oscillator. But now the situation is getting so contrived and so. I'm starting to. One quickly loses
getting
faith.
Tired of it.
Yes. You don't have to try too hard. especially, if this happened easy, if this had gone through nice and easy, then maybe you should take it a bit more seriously.
I wanted to ask about your condition that the field is exactly stationary, determinable.
Right.
Now, certainly you need that if you want an exact analog to quantum mechanics.
Yes.
But suppose you say, for instance, you look at a mode expansion and you say you want it stationary for modes above some minimum momentum, but don't require it stationary below. If you stick that in a path integral, you're still going to get some exponential suppression, but it could be potentially much smaller exponential suppression.
Right.
And
okay.
That's like gluing on most of the field to one of your escape paths, and then letting little bits of it have to.
I mean, you've still got the asymptotic play an important role there. Get rid of the high momentum there. So.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much it helped, I think the way I like to think of the no-go theorem is that in some ways it's like a guidebook, say, right, well, this is what you can't do. And this might have been what you thought was the standard thing to do, but this is what you can't do. You've got to do something a bit cleverer. Mm-hmm. And it seems that, yeah, I mean, there's various ideas floating around and things that you can try. But I think it's fair.
Special gravity, you're going to expect that something is going to get
weird.
See,
it's difficult to know what's going to happen with gravity. Our intuition is that it's going to just dampen everything. Everything's just going to go away. I mean, we were thinking of maybe playing around with some sort of mini super space type model, but I don't know.
Well, does Hawking Moss then versus
all energies are zero.
Right.
So your energy conditions is going to change. Right. Any difference in energy is just going to get swapped into gravity. So. I don't know what.
The simplest thing to do might be just to consider sort of fields propagating on a certain curve background or something. Mm.
That won't. If you don't have a dynamical gravity, then you'll miss the weird things that can happen with the energy.
Right. No. Sure. Absolutely. That's why I was saying
this. This whole argument with barriers is tricky.
Mm. But clearly, it's important because there's gravity in the landscape. Right. So,
right.
So clearly, the issue of introducing gravity is important. Just our sort of hunches is that. Because constructing interference is harder.
Yeah.
If you throw gravity, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. I'm not sure how relevant resonance something is. Yeah. Right. Is, 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 is.